And you're listening to Radio Regent. This is a Saturday Morning Live. We now go to Black Agenda Report.
Cory Booker, the new U.S. Senator from New Jersey and the darling of corporate executives everywhere, may have an early chance to show Capitol Hill his true colors on vouchers for private schools. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee has introduced a bill to transfer about 41% of federal public school monies to the states, which could then turn the funds into vouchers. Parents would be allowed to use the vouchers to pay for private schools or charter schools or a public school outside their district. It is a formula designed to hasten the already rapid dissolution of public education in America. Cory Booker began his career as an advocate of private school vouchers. Along with two prominent Republican soulmates, Booker founded a local New Jersey outfit called Educational Excellence for Everyone. That's how he first became embedded in the universe of right-wing foundations and think tanks whose pet project at the turn of the 21st century was private school vouchers. They bankrolled Booker's rise to mayor of Newark and used their media machine to make him a nationally known politician while still in his early 30s. If Booker had not narrowly lost his first bid for mayor in 2002, he, not Barack Obama, might have had the inside track on becoming the first black U.S. president. As it turned out, both Booker and Obama represent the most corporate elements of the Democratic Party and the most hostile to public education. Once he had secured a national spotlight, Booker founded another group called Democrats for Education Reform. By that time, the term reform had become a code word for charter schools and busting teachers' unions. Democrats for Education Reform morphed into a political action committee fueled by contributions from Wall Street fat cats who wanted to get a piece of the school privatization action. As always, Cory Booker was their man. Booker and Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie worked hand in hand as preachers of the school charter gospel. Both took credit for Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg's $100 million donation to Newark schools, and both made sure that charter schools got more than their fair share of the money. By 2016, thanks to Booker and to Christie, charter schools will account for more than a third of Newark student enrollment. Wall Street is betting on charter schools because that's where the most profits can be made. How could a speculator lose when the public foots the bill while the education corporations reap the rewards? That's why President Obama, the consummate corporate politician, has acted as chief national booster and bully for charter schools. However, most Democrats draw the line at private school vouchers. Cory Booker would very much like to appear to be a mainstream Democrat, the kind that can win presidential primaries or be tapped as vice presidential running mate. But Booker has never turned his back on the private school hucksters that launched his political career. He will have little choice but to vote in favor of Republican Senator Lamar Alexander's school vouchers bill, thus putting himself at odds with most of the Democratic caucus in the Senate. Booker is likely to start his tenure as senator in the same place he began his political career, in bed with the most reactionary rich white people in America. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Millie Bailey. Coming up, a federal panel says President Obama's program to spy on Americans is unconstitutional. Prison inmates face high rates of sexual abuse by guards, and a new campaign to bring Mumia Abu-Jamal home.
But first, there's the possibility that Black Libyans and supporters of Muammar Gaddafi's former government may join forces against the U.S.-installed regime. There are reports of serious fighting in southern Libya, where the population is largely dark-skinned. Political analyst Eric Dreitzer wrote an article on the secret war in Libya. Dreitzer says the country has been spiraling into chaos since the fall of Gaddafi.
Libya is a very much a divided country. It is divided geographically, it is divided ethnically and racially, and it's also, of course, divided in terms of classes. And this is something that was a decades-long project in the time of Gaddafi and the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya, was the idea of some form of socialism in order to bring together these disparate groups in order to create a unified nation. And that was very much central to the principles of Gaddafi and the Green Revolution. And so what we've seen since the assassination of Gaddafi and the destruction of Libya is that these disparities, these delineations between the groups have only grown larger. And in fact, the divide, especially between the Arab population and the Black population, has become ever more apparent. We've seen, of course, during the so-called uprising, we saw genocidal activity, ethnic cleansing carried out in the province in southern Libya against the various Black ethnic groups there. We know Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have documented the mass displacement of the Kawerga people. We know recently that we have seen Arab militias attacking the Toubou ethnic group in southern Libya as well. All of this is sort of against the backdrop of what the Western media calls the building of democracy, the establishment of a functional democracy in Libya. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Now, what we've seen in recent days, though, has been an uprising of sorts that is completely suppressed in the Western media. And this uprising of pro-Gaddafi green fighters, most recently typified by the taking of an airbase outside the city of Sabah in southern Libya. This was, I believe, Saturday, January 18th, that this took place. We also had reports filtering out of various cities, particularly in the south of Libya, that the green flag of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya was flying over a number of cities in the southern part of the country. So all of this tells us that there is some kind of a movement developing in the country, the scale of which I think is still somewhat indeterminate. But there is a movement, a pro-Gaddafi movement that is emerging, or really one that never really went away, but more kind of went underground. And so this is coinciding with the attacks upon the various Black ethnic groups of southern Libya. And so as these two forces begin to fight back against these racist and imperialist puppets that run the country of Libya, we're beginning to see a form of mass resistance. What form that ends up taking still remains to be seen.
And yet the corporate media have not spoken of resistance, either green or Black, and in many cases, again, those might be one and the same, since the triumph of the Western-backed so-called rebels.
No, and they can't, because if they were to acknowledge that, then the entire project in Libya would be called into question. Remember that the war in Libya and the aftermath of the war in Libya is sold to the Western news consumer as a war for democracy, as the establishment of a democratic country. But if you were to look at the actual on-the-ground actions, the various violent incidents, the lynchings, the rapes, the murders, the assassinations, all of that, you begin to see that that's a complete mythology. Rather, what we are seeing is a small group of hand-picked successors to Gaddafi, who are attempting to use Libya as a means to enrich their patrons in Washington, in London, in Paris, and around the world, at, of course, the cost, particularly of black Libyans in the South. Remember that the lynchings and rapes and the ethnic cleansing that took place during that war, that was actively suppressed while the war was going on. The aftermath of it, only many months later did it become known, at least among so-called sanctioned outlets in the West, of what was really happening, of the fact that the pro-Gaddafi fighters were made up of a wide variety of groups. You had the Tuaregs, who had been very closely linked to Gaddafi. You had many of the other smaller ethnic groups in the South, the Tuareg group and others, all of whom recognized that even whatever disagreements and conflicts they had with Gaddafi and his government, that they paled in comparison to their prospective future. And of course, for them now, the future is now, and their future, their present, is a very, very painful one. Not only are basic social services not even been established for them, but they have no political self-determination. They are utterly marginalized economically, and so I think it only stands to reason that they would begin to fight back, and particularly against the backdrop of these continued attacks by these Arab militias. Arab militias, I would point out, that the government in Tripoli claims to be able to control, but of course, everybody knows that they can't. There is no true central authority in Libya, unless, of course, we want to call Washington and NATO their central authority.
And since the fall of Sirte, Gaddafi's hometown and the place that he was assassinated in, we haven't heard much on the subject of ethnic cleansing from Human Rights Watch and other groups of that nature either.
No, certainly not, because remember that they played a central role in selling the war in the first place. It was Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International as well who had propagated the lies about Gaddafi's forces using rape as a weapon of war, about the notion of quote-unquote imminent genocide in Benghazi. All of these mythologies which were propagated in the Western media had their roots in the so-called NGOs, in Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the others. And so they played a central role in selling the war to the public, in creating the justification that Obama and the various other NATO governments needed to launch that war. And so they have a vested interest in making sure that the truth is to some degree suppressed. Now, to be fair, Human Rights Watch did, and Amnesty International as well, did eventually document some of the war crimes committed by the so-called freedom fighters of Benghazi, such as the touted Libyan Islamic Fighting Group led by Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists and others. They did document the displacement of the Tuareg people, but this was very much minimizing the scale of the ethnic cleansing that was happening. Much better analysis, you could look simply on YouTube for the videos that were documenting firsthand what was really happening. We had a number of activists from Western countries who went into Libya, who talked about this, who publicized this, but the corporate media and their NGOs and the various other organs of imperial soft power, all of these institutions actively suppressed that truth, and they're doing it even today for the purposes of continuing to sell the mythology of contemporary Libya.
The black tribes are centered in the south of the country, which is near the border with Chad. Chad was also the source of many of the migrant workers who were also massacred and displaced during the rebellion. What has Chad been up to?
Well, what we're seeing is that Chad and Niger as well, and the other countries in the region, are kind of in this middle ground where on the one hand they recognize the reality of the situation, but we also see AFRICOM very much heavily invested in these countries. We see a country like Niger playing host to a future U.S. drone base. We see U.S. military so-called advisors embedding themselves in the bureaucracy and the military structure of countries like Chad. And then, of course, we see what's happening in neighboring Central African Republic as well, where the French are sort of reasserting their colonial control. And I would argue that many of these developments are a direct outgrowth of the overthrow of Gaddafi. Remember that these countries were very much dependent upon Libya, not only as providing economic aid and assistance and development for them, but in terms of providing work for many of, in Libya, what they would have called migrant workers. And so the social shockwaves of the overthrow of Gaddafi have had their ripple effect in these various countries. And it's, of course, very damaging to the cause of anti-imperialism in Africa, because anybody who believes that the United States and its clients need to be ejected from the continent, they can't possibly obscure the fact that the United States and its proxies are very much in control in the countries surrounding Libya and in Libya itself through their puppets.
And what are the possibilities for a partition of Libya, an undoing of the Libyan National Project?
Well, again, that remains to be seen because, of course, in the east, centered around Benghazi and in the Cyrenaica region, you have a lot of groups who are, in fact, dissatisfied with the government in Tripoli. But these groups tend to be of the more reactionary Islamist variety, those who feel that they continue to be marginalized by a government in Tripoli that they don't even truly recognize. This government, which ostensibly is a quote-unquote liberal-minded government, really acts merely as a middleman for finance capital for Western financiers, oil companies, and others who are in Libya to exploit its natural resources and to enrich themselves. And so while the eastern portion of the country views with tremendous suspicion the government in Tripoli, both of them understand a common enemy in the south, and that being the black Libyan groups as well as the Arab pro-Gaddafi green resistance coming together possibly to form some kind of a third force in the country. Now, whether or not this is something that actually comes together or if this is merely a confluence of interests happening, you know, simultaneously, I think that remains to be seen. I'm always cautious when talking about this issue simply because the lack of reliable information coming out of Libya. The only mention of green resistance that you even saw with regard to what happened last weekend on January 18th was from the Prime Minister Zaidan himself, who merely mentioned in passing that it was green resistance fighters who had taken over the airbase. And so what we're seeing then is a splitting of the country along ethnic lines and along political lines. And whether or not those factions in the South can recognize that their interests are one and the same, I think that this is what we're looking for, because if that were to happen, one could imagine a scenario in which the South becomes a de facto independent state. If you were to have those forces come together for collective self-defense and ejecting the neocolonial puppet government out of their region, then you might see a future for Libya wherein the country is no longer one, but is split into two or three. Now, certainly, ideally, Libya would remain as one country under an independent government, but given the current situation, that seems to be an impossibility. So a de facto partition of the country is quite possible. Whether or not that's the best outcome still remains to be seen.
That was political analyst Eric Breitzer speaking from New York.
The Federal Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board issued a report declaring that the NSA program that puts all Americans' telephone and internet communications under surveillance is unconstitutional and must be halted. Civil liberties groups welcomed the report. We spoke with Carl Messonigo, legal director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. President Obama's legal strategists think they can get around prohibitions against warrantless wiretapping simply by wiretapping everybody. But Carl Messonigo says,
well, that's exactly what the reasoning is, in fact. And today is significant because the Critical Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board has issued a massive report today that finds that that reasoning doesn't fly, that it is unconstitutional reasoning, and that it's circular. Now, this is a prestigious bipartisan panel that was created by the 9/11 Commission to look and focus on civil liberties issues in the context of terrorism. And it looked at the collection of telephone data, which the government has been doing through the FISA court, apparently for years now, under the Patriot Act, and they conclude that this is flatly unconstitutional.
Well, if it's flatly unconstitutional, then all this dancing around with review boards and such and transferring data from the Fed's possession to private entities doesn't overcome the fundamental problem.
That's correct. Well, we know it's unconstitutional, and we know that the idea that the government can collect everyone's data and warehouse it, massive data warehouses, potentially forever, thereby being able to learn everyone's associations, actions, transactions, the most intimate portrait of a person's life possible. We know that that type of intelligence gathering is unconstitutional, but ultimately, we have to look at the form of government to put a stop to it. And last week, President Obama, who had advance information of this critical report, the most detailed analysis of the unconstitutionality of the bulk telephone collection process to date, he had that in hand, and yet he proceeded with his speech where he basically endorsed the continuation of the program, an absolute lack of leadership.
And what kind of weight do you think this report will carry with the Congress?
Well, I think the Congress is going to be more responsive to public outcry. And what we see across the nation is that there is a public outcry. In fact, the public opinion polls are clear that a majority of Americans recognize that there has been an unacceptable loss of civil liberties in the so-called pursuit of anti-terrorism authorities. And so we can expect Congress to be more responsive, but the fact is the leadership on this issue is not going to come from our elected leaders. It's going to come from the people. It's essential that the people understand the issues and take action, because that is what's going to turn the tide, is public sentiment. They will follow where we lead.
If maintenance of an hysteria around national security is just a pretext, as you say, to keep the surveillance state going, what is the real purpose of the surveillance state?
I think that we can see historically what happens when the government is allowed to usurp authority and take greater authority than permitted and move into a massive intelligence gathering state that's focused on domestic activities. We look at J. Edgar Hoover. This is J. Edgar Hoover's intelligence program on steroids. We look at the COINTELPRO operation, which was used then, citing prevention of violence as its chief goal. The COINTELPRO program was used to disrupt civil rights organizing, anti-war organizing, and to keep government control over progressive change in the United States. We know that that is what will happen inevitably if this authority is left in the hands of the government.
People have long been talking about U.S. intelligence agencies always being in search of enemies, but it seems that today they believe that everybody is the enemy.
Well, that's correct. And even in the leaked document that Edward Snowden has disclosed, the NSA and the U.S. government refers to the people of the United States as adversaries. We are all potential adversaries to the U.S. government. For that reason, it uses its authorities against us. We're all targets under this misguided and undemocratic intelligence operation.
It seems that people in very secret places are anticipating some kind of upheaval that we aren't even aware of.
And I think that's what's very frightening. What they have done is they've placed this surveillance grid underneath all of us. And these technologies are really technologies of social and political control. We don't know what will be the triggering event to move them out of simply passively collecting this information to using it against people. But we know historically that is what has happened whenever the government has amassed this type of intelligence gathering and operation against the people of the United States. This is exactly what will happen again in the future. We know for certain that if they are allowed to collect all of our telephone records, all of our telephone data, that they will be able to collect all of our data. And that, in fact, is the goal of the NSA. It's very clear. They want to be able to put together and aggregate data about every action, transaction, communication that we all engage in. And from that, they create a personality profile, a most intimate portrait of everything that we do. And that is simply not allowed under the Bill of Rights. It is clear that the Constitution requires the government to have probable cause or meet some other particularized standard to engage in such searching and seizure of our personal information. And it's simply not there unless, as the government appears to think, we're all criminals.
And they put together maps of social networks that include us in the company of people that we don't even know.
That's absolutely correct. And as the Oversight Committee in their extensive report, the very fact of the collection of this information, the fact that we all know that what we do and who we associate with is being recorded, by itself chills First Amendment and protected activities. And yet we know that historically such apparatuses have not merely been passive, but have actually been used to maintain the economic and political status quo, to stifle and suppress any type of progressive social and economic change, just as we saw such apparatuses being used against Dr. King himself.
Carl Massinio of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in Washington.
The latest report from the U.S. Justice Department's Bureau of Justice statistics shows continued high rates of sexual misconduct against prison inmates. The Washington-based watchdog organization Just Detention International keeps track of prison abuses. We asked Chris Daly, the group's deputy executive director, if prison guards can sexually abuse inmates with impunity.
I think it certainly feels like that. What we know is that only a small percentage of people who experience sexual abuse in detention file a report. And because of a lot of concerns about retaliation or harm to themselves or just the stigma about admitting that you've been sexually abused. And even when they do file a report, what the most recent federal report has shown us is that only 10% of those reports are sustained. So in only 10% of those cases does an agency find that, yes, sexual abuse or harassment happened. And then even when it's sexual misconduct, which includes touching or viewing people in a sexual and inappropriate way, only about half of the people are prosecuted through the criminal justice system. And about 15% of them who are found to have committed sexual misconduct, and these are staff members, about 15% of them retain their jobs. So while there's definitely some prosecution happening here, it certainly feels like impunity when you think of the huge number of men, women, and children who experience this devastating act on an annual basis.
And we're talking about a really large universe of sexual abuse. According to anonymous surveys of inmates, about 200,000 of them are sexually abused every year.
That's absolutely right. And it's in all kinds of facilities. It's in adult jails and prisons. It's in juvenile detention centers. It's in immigration detention centers and military prisons and jails. So we just see that across the board, regardless of what the population is, regardless of where they're held, there is a high rate of abuse for people that we're holding in custody in the U.S.
We also see that when people do report sexual abuse, the chances are that they won't get any medical help.
Isn't that the craziest part? Now, these are folks who we as a society have control over their access to medical care. So you would think that in a situation where someone has been sexually abused, that it would not be difficult to provide them with the emergency medical care that's necessary. The vast majority of facilities have medical folks on staff who within about a 12-hour period could easily provide people with both the emergency medical care they need and collect the evidence that's needed for a prosecution and begin the process of providing long-term medical care. And as you said very clearly, too few of these people actually get that kind of care.
And yet we also know that prisons are vectors for sexually transmitted diseases.
There's definitely some evidence that says that. I think what we absolutely know for sure is that when we speak about HIV, for instance, that the population in prison has a higher rate of HIV than the population outside of prison. And so when we're talking about any kind of sexual contact, we have to be worried about transmission, because there is, in the vast majority of these facilities, the prisoners aren't provided with even basic preventative measures. So we're absolutely talking about the risk of transmission for sure.
You have some very frightening statistics here. You say that even among those staff who are found to have perpetrated sexual misconduct, about 46% of them are referred for prosecution. Only about 27% wind up being arrested, and only 1% are convicted.
And, you know, that's both an indictment of the way in which our criminal justice system is able to effectively prosecute sexual abusers regardless of where the sexual abuse is happening. We have low rates of prosecution outside of prison as well. But certainly within the justice system, there is so much bias against prisoners. And there is so much reluctance to take the case of a prisoner who's been victimized simply because of the stereotypes about whether or not that person will make a good witness, for instance, whether they'll be believed by a jury. And so there are a number of these cases that absolutely die on the vine simply because of who the victim is, who the survivor is in that case.
Well, is there any wonder, then, that inmates are reluctant to report sexual abuse or abuse of any kind?
You see statistics like this, and you have to wonder how much bravery it takes for someone to step forward. Because the things you've laid out, both the low rates of justice that happen once a report is made, the risk of retaliation both by other prisoners and staff members, and then again, we just can't overstate how difficult it can be for folks to talk about the fact that they've been sexually abused, and without some of the support services that are available to folks outside, not universally available, but in large parts of the country that are available to folks from the outside, it's really difficult for people to come to terms with that. Now, the good news on this front is that the federal government is tracking a lot of this data. You know, we didn't have this data 10 years ago. The Prison Rape Elimination Act, which is the statute that this data was collected under, has also promulgated regulations, which are now in effect in the vast majority of facilities around the country. And the problems that we're citing, if those regulations are effectively implemented, they'll go a long way to address them.
The federal system could speak with one voice, but there are 50 other voices, state voices out there. What kind of improvements have you seen, if any, at the state level?
You're absolutely right. When it comes to prisons, we've got 50-plus our territories and districts, and then we've got hundreds upon hundreds of agencies that run local jails. We don't have data that shows that the Prison Rape Elimination Act, for instance, has started to take effect in these systems. What we do know are two very important things. That since this data started coming out in about 2007 from the Department of Justice, we've seen corrections officials who did not believe that sexual abuse in detention was a big problem or did not believe it was a problem in their facility have done a 180 and really have recognized, because of the overwhelming power and the consistency of these statistics, that this is a significant problem and that they can actually act to prevent it. And then we've seen some systems who have taken huge steps forward in implementing the regulations. And again, we'll start to have a better idea of how well they're doing in implementing the regulations once we see these audit reports that are going to come out probably in the next year to 18 months.
And among your statistics, you say that women inmates are disproportionately victimized in terms of by other inmates.
This data, when I speak broadly about the reports that the Department of Justice have done, have really, I think, helped us better understand the dynamics of sexual abuse. I don't think people would have thought that before we started to collect this information that female inmates are at higher risk than male inmates of being abused by another inmate. But what is coming back to us is absolutely that the sexual abuse against women is happening more frequently when it's inmates than sexual abuse against men.
And what kind of dynamic is at work there? That certainly is not the kind of picture that those of us on the outside imagine.
You know, we don't know. Just to be really clear, we are still unpacking how situations have been created to facilitate this kind of abuse. Certainly one of them is what you just put your finger on, that not only do folks on the outside not necessarily see that as a problem, but corrections as a profession hasn't seen it. So there hasn't been as much attention to that issue. And I think we are going to see increasingly more attention paid to making sure that inmates themselves are both safe and then when they're in unsafe situations are able to get help or to report instances of abuse much more quickly and much more effectively.
Chris Daly of Just Detention International in Washington.
A father takes his two daughters to the Brooklyn Academy of Music to learn about the Black Liberation Movement and see some films on political prisoners, but instead winds up having to listen to Bill Bratton, the man New York Mayor Bill de Blasio brought back as police commissioner. Bratton is credited with introducing stop and frisk to New York. Greg Butterfield of New Yorkers Against Bratton says Bill Bratton was the last guy he wanted his daughters to meet.
We had picked up a flyer last week for this event that sounded really wonderful. It had a picture of Dr. King on the front, and on the back it said keynote speech by Angela Davis and free film showing of a film on political prisoners. So I thought this would be an excellent place to take them to learn some of their history as black children. And when we got there, before Angela Davis ever came out, what we found was like a long parade of establishment Democratic Party speakers backslapping each other about the de Blasio election, about Obama, and people like Chuck Schumer reading from Dr. King's writings from a Birmingham jail, which was kind of stomach-churning. But what really upset me and got me to walk out of there with my kids was when they suddenly called up Bill Bratton, the new old police commissioner, one of the architects of Stop and Frisk, who's been spreading the gospel of Stop and Frisk racial profiling around the country ever since he first served under Giuliani in the 1990s. And I was just aghast that, first of all, for any Martin Luther King Day event, that they would have the gall to bring someone like that up to the stage, but then also an event that was completely built as a place to come here, this icon of black radicalism, and to see a film about political prisoners, that this forum would give a voice to this war criminal of our communities and around the country. So at that point, you know, I got my girls and we left loudly. I shouted, shame on Bratton, shame on Killer Cop Bratton, shame on de Blasio. And we left the auditorium. We were trailed for several blocks by armed police to make sure we didn't try to come back in.
You must have felt that you had been subject to the most bizarre kind of political bait and switch, but is that what de Blasio is offering? A bait and switch, offering a progressive administration and switching up with a Bill Bratton, who basically introduced Stop and Frisk to New York City.
Well, that seems to be exactly what happened there and what's happening in the city generally. It was blatant beyond even my very low expectations for de Blasio and Bratton at this point, that they would try to take over an event billed as being about political prisoners and the history of the black liberation struggle. But as you say, a lot of people have been drinking the Obama Kool-Aid and a lot of people are drinking the de Blasio Kool-Aid. I've been working with this ad hoc coalition called New Yorkers Against Bratton, which came together right after de Blasio announced that he was hiring Bratton back in early December. And it was spearheaded by some parents and family members of youth who were killed by the NYPD during Bratton's first commissionership back in the 90s, and some other organizers in the anti-police brutality movement. And it's been a struggle because a lot of the more mainstream, nonprofit-funded kind of groups have been very quiet for the last 2 months about the situation. And so we've been coming out in small but steady numbers to protest wherever we know that Bratton is going to speak. This one took me completely by surprise. And as I said in my letter that I addressed to Angela Davis the day after the event, if I had not had the responsibility for my children's safety at that event, I was so outraged, I would have tried to go up on the stage and take the mic from Bratton and denounce what a farce this was. It was so outrageous. And now we hear that even some of the city council members from the Black, Latino, and Asian caucus have sent a letter wondering why they haven't heard back from de Blasio about their request more than a month ago for an update on when he's going to drop the appeals against the Stop and Frisk cases, which he had promised to do, just as he, before his election, had promised to end Stop and Frisk and has been steadily backing off of that ever since, first saying he was going to reform Stop and Frisk and now saying he's going to curb the worst excesses of Stop and Frisk. And, of course, we saw just this week an elderly Asian man on the Upper West Side of Manhattan who was attacked and beaten by the NYPD for jaywalking, allegedly, and put in the hospital. So nothing is changing that anyone could see on the street. It's all in the realm of talk. And it really seems like de Blasio has learned a lot from the Obama playbook in terms of how to play the progressive movement and those who aren't sort of ready to stand up to the deceptions of these allegedly progressive politicians who are carrying on the same policies that we've seen under the previous administration, whether it was Bush or Bloomberg.
Greg Butterfield of New Yorkers Against Bratton.
After 32 years, the Fraternal Order of Police is still obsessed with trying to execute Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer and originally sentenced to death. Mumia has always maintained his innocence. In 2011, a federal court overturned his death sentence, reducing it to life without the possibility of parole. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund was involved in the case. President Obama recently appointed a former Defense Fund lawyer, Debo Adebile, as director of the U.S. Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. This infuriated the Fraternal Order of Police, who wrote a letter to the White House calling Mumia a three-time convicted cop killer and accusing the NAACP Legal Defense Fund of using race baiting to defend Mumia. Johanna Fernandez is a professor of history at New York's Baruch College and a member of Mumia's legal team. She helped organize an outdoor press conference in Philadelphia to announce a campaign to bring Mumia home and to denounce the police vendetta.
The Fraternal Order of Police wrote in their letter that Mumia's attorneys were race baiting and falsely using race to get Mumia off the death row. Now that is an absolute fabrication and lie. And an example of how the Fraternal Order of Police, in fact, uses race and distorts race and racial divisions to delegitimize the claims of Mumia Abu-Jamal and all of the people who've been wrongly incarcerated by the state. The fact is that the issue on which Mumia was taken off the death row was the Mills claim, which had absolutely nothing to do with racism and had everything to do with the manner in which the jury was instructed. Now, this is important because the reason why Mumia was sent to death row was because the jury thought that no one of them could actually ask to hear something about Mumia's character. They thought that in order to hear evidence on Mumia's character, they all had to agree to hear this. But any one of them could have said, I want to know more about this man. Even if they had not been improperly instructed, the defense would have said, well, members of the court, you are sending to death one of the most noted journalists of the city, someone who's been identified by Philadelphia Magazine as a journalist to watch because of his brilliant work. And someone would have said that, in fact, this man just got one of the most coveted awards in radio journalism, the Columbia University Armstrong Award for Excellence in Broadcasting. And he got that for his report on the Pope's visit to Philadelphia. Someone would have said that this is an upstanding leader in our community, a family man who loves his wife and his children, and he should not be sent to his death. But that was not allowed to be heard because the jury was misinstructed. That is known as the Mills claim. And that is the reason why four judges decided that Mumia's death sentence was unconstitutional. Again, an example of how the police, the Fraternal Order of Police, distorts the facts, manipulates information to essentially delegitimize the fact that we stand on the right side of history. We're bringing Mumia home. This movement is building, it's growing, and we need to build this movement from the bottom up, because ultimately the fight for Mumia is about the struggle to stop the state from putting so many people in prison, throwing people away, and essentially the fight to bring Mumia home is tied up in the issue of building a new society, a different society, on completely different priorities.
Johanna Fernandez. Dr. Anthony Monteiro has been active in Mumia's defense from the very beginning in the early 80s. Monteiro has been a professor of African American studies at Temple University for the last decade, but the university administration has refused to renew Monteiro's contract. Many believe in retaliation for his community activism.
At some point, white America has to confront itself and its own contradictions. It is not Mumia that they fear. It is the truth that Mumia represents that white America fears. It is not Mumia that the FOP fears. It is the truth that Mumia represents that they fear. Now, King was fond of quoting James Russell Lowell, who said in the middle of the 19th century, at the height of the enslavement of Africans, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. But it is the scaffold that they build to execute the prophets of truth. It is the scaffold that sways the future. And it is we who are on the right side of history. If this country is to survive the 21st century, if it is to survive, white America, the ball is in your court now. We African Americans have done our best. We have done all that we can do to bring civilization and humanity to this land of profit and greed. White America, the ball is in your court. Do what you say you believe in. Free Mumia, free the Move 9, free all political prisoners, and let us never forget the exemplary human being that passed away a few days ago, who would have been here with us today had he not died, the great Amiri Baraka. Thank you very, very much.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.